From the Moan Broadcast Center, it's Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. This week, our critics review the sci-fi adventure Alita Battle Angel. Stars Rosa Salazar, Christoph Waltz, and Mahershala Ali. Robert Rodriguez is the director. Isn't it a satirical romantic comedy? Stars Rebel Wilson and Liam Hemsworth, and we'll hear about the obligatory Valentine's Day weekend horror film, Happy Death Day to You.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances, for consideration in all categories.
And by Marvel Studios' Black Panther, now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including Costume and Production Design, Score, Original Song, All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
Welcome to Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. As we head into a 3-day President's Day weekend, Sunday afternoon, all our critics on stage, Theater at Ace Hotel downtown, for our annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. I can't believe it would be the 17th year. Our first years were at the Egyptian Theater in Hollywood, and the event became so big we couldn't fit it in the Egyptian. Now we are in the much larger historic theater that began life as the United Artists, the Theater at Ace Hotel on South Broadway. We still have some tickets that are available. They are getting a little short, but you can get yours at kpecc.org/in-person. I'm very pleased to be joined this week by film critics Amy Nicholson, who writes on film for The Guardian and hosts the podcast The Canon and Unspooled. Peter Rayner is film critic for the Christian Science Monitor and just back from the Santa Barbara Film Festival in that beautiful city. He'll tell us about that later. And Charles Solomon, animation critic for Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. We begin with Alita Battle Angel, sci-fi action-adventure directed by Robert Rodriguez. He co-wrote the screenplay with James Cameron. It's based on the manga Battle Angel Alita by Yukito Kishiro, about a deactivated female cyborg who's revived but can't remember anything of her past life.
You've been given a chance to start over with a clean slate. How many of us get that
chance? Why did an enemy warship respond to me? Because I knew that ship. I've been on others like it, haven't I? Haven't I?
Oh, whatever you were, it's not who you are now.
I'm a warrior, aren't I?
Rosa Salazar, Christoph Waltz, Mahershala Ali, Jennifer Connelly star in Alita Battle Angel. Before we hear our critics' opinions about the film, Charles, can you give us a little background on the evolution of the movie?
Well, this is something Cameron's been talking about since at least 2004. I found things where he proclaimed they were going to make it this way. This is very much almost a genre of manga and anime, the post-apocalyptic dystopia that's in ruins. Some of it comes from, I'm blanking on the name of the film, Blade Runner. The original was very influential. But also, Japan is the only country that has ever experienced a nuclear attack. And so, as well as having disastrous weather and earthquakes, so that kind of setting runs through a lot of anime and manga, as does the kind of amnesiac female warrior. That's Major Kusanagi in Ghost in the Shell, any number of things. Also part of it that I would expect to hear some feminist critics talking about is that these characters often acquire either armor or a cyborg body that kind of simultaneously empowers and degrades, that it gives them the power to, you know, punch through things and kick through things and leap over things. But it also involves a structure that would make Barbie feel under endowed.
So sexualized,
yeah,
as well.
Very, very much sexualized. And again, Wonder Woman looks like, just can't compare to some of these heroines.
We're talking about Alita Battle Angel. What did you think about it, Peter?
I sort of enjoyed it. The buzz on this was not good. And so I went in, you know, expecting a colossal disaster. And I thought it was kind of fun. It's sort of overlong and overstuffed. But the Rosa Salazar is quite good. As you know, it's good performance capture work, I think, in this film. You know, there's a lot of dystopian stuff that goes on. The most of it's taking place in this Iron City, which is essentially one big junkyard. Christoph Waltz is for a change playing a good guy, although for a while it seems like he might not be a good guy. There's a game called Motorball that's very much like Rollerball that's in this movie. It's violent, but not in a way that's offensive or out there.
PG-13 rated.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not the hugest fan of these kinds of films, and I'm not sure that this was worth 15 years in the making and then some. It's set up for a sequel, as all these films are. But I guess Cameron himself was going to direct this way back when, and then he got so involved with the Avatar sequels that he handed it off to Rodriguez, who has some experience with, you know, Sin City in this genre. So, you know, I mean, I thought it was enjoyable enough.
Amy, what do you think of Alita: Battle Angel?
Well, I probably spent the first hour of it rolling my eyes, and then at the end, I was completely won over. The final half hour is like, you've got me. Fine, I'd see another battle, Alita Angel. I keep getting the words all in different orders because it's just a Scrabble title. But, yeah, I mean, to Charles's point about, like, the female bodies in here, you know, she begins as sort of a prepubescent girl, and then when she gets a little bit older into the movie, she gets to swap out her body, and it has, I would say, a slightly bigger chest.
Slightly
bigger chest. I mean, I couldn't help half of the time that I was watching this movie thinking like, oh, this is designed for like people at home, nerds, their dream girlfriend. You know, she's got a perfect figure. She'll beat up anybody who messes with you. She's great at sports. You know, she's really adventurous.
She'll give you her heart.
She'll literally give you her heart. Her one of the
perfect
things
Valentine's
that, like,
Day.
Exactly. One of the things that happens really early on is she like falls in love with the first boy she really sees, and their romance. It's actually very much a romantic film. Kind of carries the plot of it. It's not so much like vengeance. The main thing that's on her mind is I love my boyfriend. Oh my god! And you know, it actually does feel like a young girl in love with her boyfriend. It's a little bit idealized. She's like, I'm on the back of your motorcycle, honey. One thing I thought was sort of funny is, like, her boyfriend's friends keep calling her a hard body because she's, you know, built of different parts. But that's exactly what the people in American Psycho call, like, hot women. And so I was wondering how much James Cameron was thinking of that. It kept striking me as just super bizarre.
Well, remember the Terminator movies,
That's a liquid body in the second one.
What did you think, Charles?
I'm the least enthusiastic of us. I believe in recycling and reusing, but not necessarily in filmmaking. There are big chunks of, again, Blade Runner and Akira and Ghost in the Shell and Appleseed and any number of anime films in it. And for what it cost, you could have made between 20 and 30 anime features that I think would be more effective. For some reason, they give her these enormous eyes that look like fried eggs. They're so big. I guess it's trying to emulate that look from manga and anime, but it's kind of creepy. Most of the mocap is pretty good, though there are some uneven spots where clearly it looks as if shots have been farmed out and that not everybody could handle the models as well as others. For what it cost and the time I spent watching it, I think there are more interesting things you can do in a similar vein.
I'm curious about the dialogue that's been for James Cameron bit to me is Achilles' heel, is dialogue. How is it here, Peter?
I thought it was acceptable. I mean, I didn't hear too many clinkers. It's not, we're not talking Bob Town dialogue here.
But or Noel Coward.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, I think Jennifer Connelly gets one real clinker of a line. She's like, I am a mother.
Yeah,
I mean, I had forgotten
Christoph
that.
Waltz. You know, whenever you see Christoph Waltz, you're expecting Tarantino dialogue. So you don't get that here.
There are three screenwriters credited for the film. Cameron's, I mentioned, the director, Robert Rodriguez, and Laeta Kalogridis, who also one of the three screenwriters of the film. Alita: Battle Angel, rated PG-13 in wide release. The satirical romantic comedy, Isn't It Romantic, stars Rebel Wilson and Liam Hemsworth. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, well, the big studio rom-com is back, baby. I'm excited about this. I've been waiting for these films for basically 10 years. We haven't had gigantic studio romantic comedies of this size, of this ambition, and of a movie that basically just makes fun of everything that came before. Isn't It Romantic is one of its many writers is Katie Silberman, who did Set It Up this summer. Like, the romantic comedy that I think really started to get this motor running of how people really do want to see romantic comedies again. And here, this is a film where she basically has a character, Rebel Wilson, who does not believe in any sort of romance, hates romantic comedies, begins the movie with a tirade of every single cliche from every Reese Witherspoon, Julia Roberts film, which you know that then she will have to perform.
Let's hear an example of it from Isn't It Romantic, directed by Todd Strauss-Schulzen, about a young woman disenchanted with love, mysteriously finding herself trapped in an alternate universe.
Now I have a gay sidekick who's setting gay rights back like 100 years.
I love working the legs.
And guys looking me in the eyes.
You're quite beguiling, aren't you?
Are you feeling what I'm feeling?
No!
Bit of an example of what you're talking about, Amy.
Yeah, I mean, if you want to picture this rom-com world that she wakes up in after she hits her head, there's cupcake stores everywhere, bridal stores, flowers everywhere. She's allergic to flowers. People who love romantic comedies will notice that whenever she has to go to a dinner scene, she's, you know, dressed up like Julia Roberts exactly in Pretty Woman. You know, I sat next to Peter for this in movie, and I will say that I laughed a lot, and he was stone cold silent.
But I didn't hear you laughing a lot.
I did. Maybe I was.
It was the sound of one hand laughing. Right.
Peter, what did you think?
I brought a tape recorder to that screening. Okay, I think anti cliches are just as annoying as cliches, and. I mean, yes, it's sort of funny to see them run through, you know, there's the gay best friend, there's the makeover montage, there's a slow-mo race to stop the wedding scene. You know, there's all of these cliches that are part of rom-com lore. But part of it is that I don't find Rebel Wilson to be a terribly engaging, funny comedian in the way that, say, Melissa McCarthy is in these kinds of roles. And I also thought that there was too much. She's too quick to not like this rom-com world that she's in before she turns on it. So to me, there wasn't enough of a disparity between, oh, wow, this is amazing. Everyone loves me, this handsome guy and everybody. You know, there should have been more of that to then, you know, after a while say, well, gee, this isn't really what I want. You know, and there's the one boyfriend who sees her for what she is, and you know, and unlike everyone else in the paradise rom-com world, is sees her for what she is. You know, I don't know. I just thought it was a variation on something that they were making fun of, but they were also playing into it.
All right, the film is Isn't It Romantic, rated PG-13. Erin Cardillo, Dana Fox, and Katie Silberman are the screenwriters. Happy Death Day to You is our Valentine's Day horror film, sequel to 2017's Happy Death Day, written and directed by Christopher Landon, stars Jessica Roth, who returns as college student Tree Gelpman, and will have to once again die to save her friends.
Everything's different this time.
Now,
the killer is coming after all of us.
Ryan!
That means I'm going to have to die over.
Bye!
And over again. To save all of you?
Damn, this is crazy, man.
Happy Death Day to you, Amy.
Well, so Happy Death Day, if anybody out there saw that, which a lot of people did, that's why there's a sequel, is about a sorority girl, you know, terrible blonde, horrible, mean, who keeps reliving this night of a one-night stand where she wakes up in a strange guy's bed and then has to figure out, like, how she's going to get murdered by the end of the day. That was more of a straight horror film. You know, people were jumping out of closets, you know, creepy baby mask men with knives. This is more just a straight comedy. They're just sort of leaning into Tree herself because Jessica Roth is really funny in these movies. You know, she's got the big blonde hair and her exasperation at being back in a series of wake-ups in the same bed again. She's just so fed up with it. The plot, basically, what's happening here is that what started her death loop was this, like, invention that these nerds are building on campus. And so she meets the nerds and realizes they split her into an alternate reality. And now she wants to combine her realities and be back in the correct one. To do that, she has to give them time to work on the machine, which means every day she just has to kill herself so that they get more time to, like, keep building their science experiment. And she is just so ferocious and mad about it. and hilarious. And then she gets good at math, of course. And there's comedy in the sorority girl getting good at math. I mean, this film is basically just ridiculous nonsense. And I had a ton of fun.
Okay.
All right. I guess the theme for this week is alternate realities.
Yes, it
right?
is.
It really is.
Yeah. Happy Death Day to you. Jessica Roth stars Christopher Landon, the writer-director, rated PG-13, and it is in wide release. We have many more films to talk about this week, including the biographical comedic drama Fighting With My Family, Lords of Chaos, and Birds of Passage. That's all to come up right here on Film Week on KPCC. But time is running short. If you want to get your tickets to join us Sunday afternoon, 1 o'clock, Theater at Ace Hotel, it's the 17th annual Film Week Academy Awards preview. Our critics will be there on stage in the beautiful, historic Theater at Ace Hotel. Began life as the United Artists. And I can't tell you what a great feeling it is to sit in a group of more than 1,000 film lovers watching on this huge screen the clips that we've chosen for the Best Picture nominees, to see those great performances, beautifully shot films. Your tickets are available at kpcc.org/in-person. Looking forward to seeing you Sunday afternoon at 1. We're back in 1 minute. Good to have you with us on Film Week. I'm Larry Mantle. We're just talking during that minute about the Oscars and how they're going to give out some of the awards during the breaks. I think cinematography and film editing are going to be during the commercials.
Yeah. Right. Disaster.
It's nice to know that you know, if you're a cinematographer, you're going to be part of the bathroom break.
Well, yeah.
It's not like your work is important in the film.
Setting aside the statement about those categories, just logistically, trying to have people who aren't, you know, the full host of the telecast, experience live TV people, fit those awards into the breaks without running over. This is going to be very interesting to watch.
Yeah, and they're going to edit these speeches as the show is going on, so they can show little blips from the acceptance speeches later on in the show. So technically, the categories will be there, you know, on screen, but who knows who's going to be doing the editing and what, you know. And just one quick point, if this is all about, you know, saving time on the show, how is it that the same Academy wanted to create a popular film award that got shot down last summer, you know, which would have certainly added another half an hour to the show with 10 nominees, right?
All right. Well, the Oscars, of course, coming up in a couple of weekends next weekend, I should say. And our Film Week Oscar show coming up this weekend, Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. We continue with this week's films with Fighting With My Family. It's a British-UK co-production biographical comedic drama starring Florence Pugh, Jack Lowden, and Nick Frost. It's written and directed by Stephen Merchant. Peter?
This is pretty terrific, and it's not a rock movie, and they're sort of promoting it that way. He's in the ads. He's in it for about 7 minutes. It's based on a real family, the Knight family. There was a documentary in 2012 about them. They're a wrestling family, and the daughter, you know, became a big wrestling star named Paige, professional name. And Florence Pugh, who plays Paige in the film, is a marvelous actress. She was in a film a couple of years ago, you know, Lady Macbeth. And she's been in, you know, other...
Talk about a totally different role.
Yeah. I mean, she's very versatile. Here she's playing a sort of, you know, goth, a girl from, you know, Norwich, England. And she, you know, she's got a nose ring and a lip ring, excuse me. And you know, it. But she and her brother are both chosen to try out for the WWE. And he's not picked. Very good actor named Jack Lowden. So he's kind of resentful of that, but she goes to the kind of minor league WWE boot camp run by Vince Vaughn. Very good performance. And she's up against all these, you know, Barbies and fitness models who are also there. But one of the very nice things about the movie is that these fitness models are turn out to be full-fledged characters who have real lives, and you know, you understand why they're doing this, and you know, one is doing it to, you know, because she needs to pay for her daughter's education and so forth. You know, I mean, everyone in this movie is a fully rounded character. Nick Frost and Lena Headey play the parents, and they're both wonderful. The wrestling scenes are well done. Stephen Merchant, who wrote and directed it, is an actor, writer, director from England who's best known for the UK version of The Office, very different from this film. So I mean, it's predictable. We know how it's going to turn out, but that doesn't matter because what you are watching all along the way is so entertaining.
Well, Matt D'Angelo Antonio, our producer, is saying that Paige herself was a goth girl from England and really famous in the WWE women's division until 2017 when injuries forced her retirement.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I don't watch a whole lot of wrestling, but my
image. But the bit you do.
No, when I was a kid, I used to, you know, Haystacks Calhoun and you know, all those guys. But I just remember Max von Sydow and Hannah and her sisters, that scene where he's watching wrestling on TV. And he goes, imagine the mentality of the people who watch this stuff. You don't have to love wrestling to like this movie.
Fighting with My Family, written and directed by Stephen Merchant, rated PG-13.
I should say wrestling, quote unquote, because there's a funny moment in the movie where somebody refers to what they do as fake, and he goes, it's not fake, it's fixed.
The film is screening at the ArcLight Hollywood and the AMC Century City. Lords of Chaos, a biographical horror film starring Rory Culkin and Emery Cohen. Jonas Åkerlund is the director and co-screenwriter. Amy.
I love this film, and I've been waiting for this film to come out since last year, Sundance. It was tied as one of my top two favorite films with Sorry to Bother You last year. This film is about the Norwegian black metal scene in the late 80s, early 90s, and Jonas Åkerlund was sort of a distant part of it. He was in Sweden in a group called Bathory. So this is a scene he knows well. Like, Norwegian black metal, picture corpse paint, you know, the black goo kind of dripping down from your eyes, and picture these three people, real-life characters, Euronymous, Varg, and Dead. They were three people who were like part of this band scenes, and there were murders involved. They burned churches. They did a lot of things. One of them wound up dead. One of them wound up in prison. And this is sort of a comic story-ish about them. Because what
– comic story of satanic metal.
It is, because what Jonas Åkerlund does really smart is he makes this film sort of about poser ideas, about these kids trying to look tough and really upping the stakes for each other, about like – their influence on each other to try to be the most evil, the most sinister, you know, to leave voicemails that say things like, we can't come to the phone right now because we're too busy sacrificing children. I mean, he understands that these guys were terrifying and did terrible things and were also kind of a joke and were also really deeply insecure. And so I just enjoy this film so much. You know, he has this really good eye for things like capturing Varg, who went on to make music under the name Burzum, which is pretty well known. He still makes music today. Like, alone in his room, in corpse paint, eating a piece of toast. And so I just found this film incredibly delightful. I think he has, like, Jonas Åkerlund, he comes out of the music video world, so he has a really great eye for things. He has a great eye for the energy. There's a lot of tongues out and devil horns. And I thought a lot of emotion. So I really hope people check out this film.
It's based on the book Lords of Chaos, The Bloody Rise of the Satanic Metal Underground. Lords of Chaos, the film, is rated R. It's at the Fine Arts Theater in Beverly Hills. Birds of Passage, a Colombian film starring Carmina Martinez, and it's directed by Cristina Gallego and Ciro Guerra. The film's unrated. Amy?
Yeah, this is sort of the Colombian godfather, I would say. You know, a film about the rise of the drug industry in a rural part of Colombia from the 60s to the 80s. You know, a few families in charge of it, a few families and their friends. And yet it is completely its own distinct movie because it really sets this not in the world of like slick dudes. It doesn't look at all like how you're picturing. It's set in among the rural tribe of these indigenous people called the Wayuu, who began to become marijuana farmers and marijuana traffickers while bringing with it like their own set of culture and their own set of houses and their own set of beliefs. Like, it looks very unique, unlike any other film you've ever seen about this kind of story. You might think that if you watch Birds of Passage that the arcs of it are true. You know, there's like a screw-up son who's basically like the Fredo who comes in with this ridiculous afro. And yet, like, this film, I thought, just had such a distinctive personality and a really beautiful cinematography. There's a lot of deaths, of course, and, you know, you might be like, I know exactly what's going to happen here. However, I really thought that this film was doing something unique and special. If you're a mafia movie person, which I am not, this is like the type of mafia movie you might really like. That might add something to your mafia rainbow.
Birds of Passage, Peter?
Yeah, I would say it's The Godfather is a bit of a stretch. It's sort of like the Colombian loving Pablo in some ways. I mean, it is a fascinating movie because it does deal with a real subject, you know, in the 70s, you know, the Wayuus, which are, you know, very traditional indigenous people. You know, the drug traffic sort of infiltrated the community and ripped it apart. And I guess, you know, at its best, that's what this movie is about. Marijuana is actually the main drug here. And it started out by selling marijuana to gringos who were there, you know, and then it sort of escalated from there. But I think for me, the magical realist aspects of this movie were fascinating, but it didn't go quite far enough. Whenever you were sort of in the territory of Embrace of the Serpent, which was a film that this couple did previous to this, the directors, it was at its most fascinating, but then it sort of moved into more of a sort of traditional, gang drug stuff, which you've seen before, even though this is a new setting. So it didn't hold my interest in that level. But the matriarch of the clan, played by Carmina Martinez, is quite imposing. And there's a wonderful scene early on, a kind of courtship dance between the young daughter who sort of is coming out and is they have this. I don't know what the exact name of the dance is, but it's a fascinating piece of indigenous culture. I wish there was more of that in the movie.
Birds of Passage, the film, it's directed by Cristina Gallego and Ciro Guerra, who were both interviewed by The Frame's John Horn. If you'd like to hear that conversation with the directors of Birds of Passage, you can go to our Film Week page, kpcc.org. We have a link to it there. Birds of Passage is unrated. It's at Lemley's Royal Theater in West Los Angeles. Mirai is one of the five nominees for Best Animated Feature at this year's Oscars. The Japanese film is written and directed by Mamoru Hosoda. Charles, Mirai, I know you're very high on this film.
Yeah, well, in the last several years, Hosoda has emerged as one of the most interesting writer-directors working in animation, not just in Japan, but I think period. And while this isn't my favorite of his films, it's very charming. It's about a little boy named Kun, who is happily spoiled, and then the unthinkable happens. His parents bring home a baby sister, and suddenly he is no longer the center of the family universe. And through a series of magical adventures, he interacts with different family members. He meets his mother, who's always telling him to pick up his toys, as a little girl who is an absolute terror. He meets his grandfather, whose advice he learns and becomes able to ride a bike. Very warm, very charming, very different from all the other nominees, and well worth seeing.
And we remind you that we'll spend considerable time, our Film Week Academy Awards preview, at the Theater at Ace Hotel on Sunday on the category of Best Animated Feature. Mirai is showing at Lemley's Glendale and Lemley's Monica Film Center over the next couple of days and will be in select theaters next week. It's rated PG. The documentary, The Image Book, is from Jean-Luc Godard. And Peter, you've seen it. What'd you think?
I'm not sure, Larry. I mean,
we'll give you another week. Come on. Yeah,
I mean, this is another sort of infuriatingly incomprehensible Godard movie made up entirely of archival images. He digitally altered them. He bleached and washed them. Most of the imagery is taken from classic movies from the history of film, including Hollywood movies. And so, I mean, after a while, this sort of, for me, was sort of like a very highbrow version of one of those Chuck Braverman montages where, you know, you see a million movies and you have to sort of figure out what the clips are, you know. And I kind of wish that some of them had been identified on the screen, but that would have been, you know, way too plebeian for this film to actually tell you what you're watching. Having said that, there is, you know, some of the imagery is powerful, even though it's all archival. It's the bleaching and so forth gives it a certain shimmer. Godard has his scratchy, gravelly voiceover, you know, which you can you can't understand, really, you know. I mean, thank God there are subtitles. But, you know, and there's all sort of highfalutin stuff about, you know, you have to think with your hands and you separate the sound. I mean, go see it if you're a Godard completist.
The Image Book from Jean-Luc Godard. It's at the American Cinematheque at the Aero Theater in Santa Monica. The film is unrated. Coming up, we'll talk about The Breaker Upperers, a New Zealand romantic comedy, and A Tuba to Cuba, a documentary about the leader of the wonderful Preservation Hall Jazz Band searching for his family's musical and geographic roots. We'll talk about that and also hear what Peter has to say about the Santa Barbara Annual Film Festival, some of his favorites that were screened there. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. Much more to talk about, including some of our listeners' favorite remakes of foreign language films. Back shortly.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Warner Brothers Pictures, presenting the soulfully authentic A Star is Born, starring Bradley Cooper, Lady Gaga, and Sam Elliott in their Academy Award-nominated performances. Now nominated for 8 Academy Awards, including Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. Kenneth Turan of the Los Angeles Times calls it passionate, emotional, and fearless. And AFI calls the film a stellar achievement in its own universe, for consideration in all categories.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Marvel Studios, presenting Black Panther. The LA Times raves Black Panther is the cinematic event of the year. Vanity Fair calls it a political and social triumph. USA Today acclaims Black Panther is a rousing cultural movement. And now nominated for 7 Academy Awards, including costume and production design, score, original song All the Stars, performed by Kendrick Lamar and SZA, and Best Motion Picture.
You've seen the movie San Andreas, right?
Natalie, I'm gonna need you to stay calm, honey.
I've got some bad news for you. When the big one hits, The Rock won't save you. Want to know how to get ready for the next major quake? I'm Jacob Margolis, science reporter and host of KPCC's new podcast, The Big One, your survival guide. Prepare yourself. Listen in Apple Podcasts.
KPCC podcasts are supported by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting The Favorite, now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including Best Director Yorgos Lanthimos, Best Actress Olivia Colman, Best Supporting Actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, Best Original Screenplay, Best Costume Design, Best Film Editing, Best Production Design, Best Cinematography, and Best Picture of the Year. For your consideration.
I look forward every week to Film Week, get together with our terrific critics, talk about the movies as we're doing, but also special topics. We'll do that in a moment with Peter Rayner and the Santa Barbara Film Festival. And I also ask you your favorite American remake of a foreign language film. That, of course, because of Alita Battle Angel, which is out this week. I'm joined by critics Peter Rayner, Charles Solomon, and Amy Nicholson. The Breaker Upperers is a New Zealand romantic comedy starring Madeline Sami and Jackie Van Beek. It's written and directed by Sami and Van Beek. Amy, what'd you think?
Yeah, I'm going to use the word I've been using about pretty much every review so far, which is this movie is super, super fun. What this movie is about...
Nothing wrong with a week of fun movies.
This is a good date week movie.
Particularly if you're a goth.
Yeah. Although this movie is actually on Netflix right now. What this movie is about is, you know, these two women, Madeline Sami and Jackie Van Beek, they're New Zealand comedians. You have seen them in the back of a lot of films with Taika Waititi and Jermaine Clement. This is their first star role that's making it here with Taika Waititi producing. So it has that New Zealand style of humor where everybody's very nervous and polite and they're stumbling over their own sentences and everyone's awkward, that kind of what we do in the shadows type of humor. In the service of a plot that's like really wicked and mean, at least for the first hour, the setup here is that Madeline and Jackie, their characters Jen and Mel, they met 15 years ago when they realized they were dating the same man. And since then, they've become incredibly bitter about romance, and they have formed a company where they break up your relationship. If you're too nice and nervous to do it yourself, they will disrupt your wedding wearing a pregnant belly. They will fake your own death. They will do whatever it takes to get you out of your unhappy relationship, even if the other person's very nice and showing up at their office like, I'm so sad he's dead. Can we talk about it? And so it's just, I mean, the first half of this movie is almost half montage, you know, just like all these different breakups. And it's terrifically fun, you know, and in the second half, they have to build towards an actual story and everybody gets a Ooh. Hug. It climaxes with a soul train. You know, this is a very, very nice film in the final part. But my gosh, it's so funny and terrific at the beginning.
I think you could run that service off the internet.
The Breaker Upperers is streaming on Netflix. It's unrated, written and directed by and starring Madeline Sami and Jackie Van Beek. A Tuba to Cuba follows the leader of the Preservation Hall Jazz Band, looking for his late father's family background by going to Cuba. Charles, what'd you think?
Well, this is hosted by Ron Jaffe, whose parents created Preservation Hall. I assumed it was something much older. It was something they started, I guess, in the early 60s. And who doesn't love the Preservation Hall Jazz Band? And they go to Cuba, you know, jam with Cuban musicians there. There's a very interesting sequence where they look at one particular kind of Cuban jazz that's descended from African slaves imitating and parodying the formal dances that their French masters had done. And you can see in this much more jazzy, fluid, rhythmic forms the echoes of the old figure dances. And there's a very touching moment where one of the Cubans has a rock that his family tradition maintains, an ancestor who was enslaved, kept with him from Africa. It was a little piece of his home that he kept with him. And when one of the American black musicians sees it, he's moved to tears. The weak spot of this movie, though, is that he talks about the links between New Orleans jazz and Cuban influences and doesn't really explore those. I don't think I learned.
That's a very rich subject here.
Yeah, I don't think I learned as much about it as I would have liked to, but it's a very warm, very winning film. And again, these people are all clearly having so much fun, both the musicians from both places and the audiences, that you'd have to be a real Grinch not to, to be carried along with it.
Well, as a big fan of the band, I've checked out the film. Sounds great. Tuba to Cuba is unrated. It's at Limley's Glendale Theater. Let's turn our attention now to the Santa Barbara Film Festival. Peter is there every year. And Peter, you have several films that you particularly enjoyed. First of all, the overall festival itself.
It was, except for some polar vortex weather and some downpours. Viggo Mortensen was given a tribute. He had to be flown in by helicopter from Camarillo to attend his tribute. Michael B. Jordan was there. It was sort of like the Beatles had arrived, you know, with all the screaming. And he explained that he wasn't named after the basketball player, but after his father, who was also named Michael Jordan. Melissa McCarthy and Glenn Close and many others are there. It was all very, you know, informative. They also have a ton of movies that they show, often out-of-the-way indie movies and docs and films that, you know, are waiting to be picked up. And so I'll talk about
some Zulu
of those.
Summer, do you want to talk about?
Yeah, I mean, Zulu Summer is a very interesting movie, and it's the perfect public radio movie, too. There was a His Royal Highness Prince Sibanye-Iso Tobu Zulu from South Africa wanted to learn more about America. And so he reached out to all of these, you know, public radio stations in America and got a response from a small community station, low wattage, in Butte, Montana. So lo and behold, the prince and several of his associates show up in Butte, you know, in full African regalia. They're greeted at the airport, and they spent, I think, the better part of the summer interacting with the community. Had a radio show while they were there. They were part of a July 4th parade. They spoke at the Evel Knievel Festival that they have every year.
They really did get America.
Yeah, I mean, you know, they met Bernie Sanders. They went to barbecues, and I mean, it was just. But it's you know, when you keep waiting for something horrible to happen, you know, some racist something or other to encroach, and nothing ever happens. I don't know that it's the most racially mixed community in America. And
Montana, probably not.
I mean, there is a scene that was cut out, according to the director, you know, the Joseph Linziger and Eric Schrader, where they meet with the Creek Indians. That's not in the film. But I wonder if there was any African-Americans at all in Butte, because we don't see them interact with the Zulus. But it's just a wonderful, you know, very heartwarming in the best sense movie that, that really gives you a sense of, you know, people coming together from totally different cultures, and the, and seeing these guys, you know, going all around Butte and getting, you know, interacting with these people who are both, you know, sort of appreciative and goggle-eyed, is just a lot of fun.
When I was a teenager, our next door neighbors in the Hollywood Hills, Japanese American man whose family ran the only Chinese restaurant in Butte, Montana.
Really?
Yes. And in fact, they weren't interned because, you know, being so far inland running this old Chinese restaurant,
right, right,
they were not interned during World War II. But wow, he had stories about growing up in Butte being
what
Japanese
is it about
American.
Butte?
Well, I remember NPR always used to have, all things considered, have Kim Williams from Butte going out picking wild rose hips for tea and things.
So yeah, that's Zulu summer. Real quickly, Echo in the Canyon, which is Laurel Canyon in the music scene?
Yeah, it's the Laurel Canyon music scene in the mid-60s and how folk rock sort of grew out of that. Jacob Dylan, the son of Bob Dylan, is a featured player in it. It was directed by Andrew Slater. And there are all sorts of great interviews with Eric Clapton, Stephen Stills, Graham Nash, Crosby, Jackson Browne, Brian Wilson, many others, all talking about that era. And there are clips of them, you know, both from the 60s. You know, there's also, you know, the Mamas and the Papas and Buffalo Springfield. There's also part of a clip from a 2015 tribute concert. It really is a marvelous music documentary that has been picked up by Greenwich Film. So it will be distributed at some point this year, hopefully. But it really does give you a sense of that community in Laurel Canyon.
Every time I drive down Laurel Canyon, it's what comes to mind. I look at, oh, who lived in that house? And who, because it's just, it's so much a part of the mythos of Laurel Canyon.
I mean, and they all went, you know, they all jammed in each other's living rooms, and they talk about that in the film. You know, and the funniest part is when Crosby is talking to Jacob about Dylan, and Jacob goes, you'll have to be more specific. Who are you talking about?
We're almost out of time. That's Echo in the Canyon. Angel Face, can you give us 30 seconds on that film?
Yes. Marion Cotillard gives a terrific performance. It's a uneven movie, but you know, she is always terrific. And Ashes Purest White is the new film from Gia Jeanquet, which is quite interesting and will be opening in a month here.
All right. Very good. Those few of the highlights from the Santa Barbara Film Festival. Peter Rayner, just back from there. It went through last weekend. Coming up, we'll talk about what are some of our critics' favorite remakes of foreign language films into American movies. That very much thematic with this week's opening of Alita Battle Angel. We'll be talking about that. And you can post your suggestions on our Film Week page at kpecc.org. We'll be back in just 1 minute. It's Film Week on 89.3 KPECC. I'm Larry Mantle. Every few weeks we get, it seems, a remake of a foreign language film in which an American filmmaker or the original director, screenwriter of the foreign language film gets a crack at doing it in English. Most of them don't measure up to the original source material, but there are a few that have really stood out over the years. And I wanted to hear from our critics, Charles Solomon, Amy Nicholson, and Peter Rayner, their thoughts. Charles, you have a particular strong remake that stands out to you?
I've been trying to think of one, and the animated ones have all been pretty disastrous. When you think about, like, the Dragon Ball movie or Speed Racer or Ghost in the Shell, and heaven help us, somebody's going to try and do a live remake of Cowboy Bebop. So I think I'm going to have to pass to my more knowledgeable live action co-panelists on this one, because I keep drawing a blank.
Really, Amy?
You know, there is a cult of Speed Racer, right? People love the American Speed Racer.
Well, I mean, it was translated, but the live action, the recent film they made, you couldn't tell where they were in the race.
I just remember the earworm theme song from Speakers.
Well, for me, the one that comes to mind and is that I really love the American version of Let the Right One In, called Let Me In Here, done by Matt Reeves. I actually think it's superior to the Swedish version. This is the film about the young boy who falls in love with the young girl vampire who lives in his apartment complex, who lives with her older handler. And in the American version, the older handler, who's also her ex-boyfriend from when he was young and a child, is played by Richard Jenkins. And I just think Richard Jenkins' performance is so superior to the Swedish actor, who is great, but it's Richard Jenkins, one of our greatest living treasures, that that character, which I believe is so much the fulcrum of the movie beyond the two young vampire teens, that it's just, it's superior. And also, you know, there are no animated cats in the American remake. So I love Let Me In.
Boingo writes on the page, David Fincher's The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, the English language. I don't know whether you preferred that or not.
Would you count Star Wars and The Hidden Fortress?
I don't. You can count whatever you want, Charles.
Would that count as a...
I think the short answer might be
that
no.
Was unacknowledged for a time, right? Also, Triumph of the Will is part of the... yes, I've prepared for this, Larry.
Yeah,
so,
good. I see you.
So I'll just... Boudou, Save from Drowning, Jean Renoir's great movie with Michelle Simone, was made as Down and Out in Beverly Hills with Nick Nolte. Another great Renoir movie, La Chienne, was made into a terrific noir with Edward G. Robinson called Scarlet Street with...
I love Scarlet Street.
Fritz Lang directed. Yeah. La Jetée, the great Chris Marker short film, 12 Monkeys, was Terry Gilliam. Ossessione, which was a great neorealist picture by Visconti, was made several times. The Postman Always Rings Twice.
I didn't know that was based on...
Yeah, in fact, it wasn't. It couldn't be shown in America for many years, the Italian film, because of rights problems with James M. Cain. But it was it's the same story.
Yeah, because it's an American novelist, I just assumed it would first be made here.
Right. No, it was made there. I guess because they're sultrier in Italy and they get around the
source
ratings.
Source material a little racy. Yeah.
Right. And then La Cage aux Folles became The Birdcage, which was very entertaining. Pepe Lamoco was made almost shot for shot as Algiers with Hedy Lamarr. And Charles Boyer, the great now of Smiles of a Summer Night, the great Bergman movie, was Little Night Music, which some people don't realize.
That was via the stage.
Right. But, yeah, it was made into a film. Seven Samurai, of course, was Magnificent Seven. And Yojimbo was Fistful of Dollars. Solaris was remade not very well. The Tarkovsky film in Hollywood by... Soderbergh, I believe, yeah. And, you know, I mean, there are a lot of... Victoria was actually a German movie that was made by Blake Edwards.
Yeah, hard to believe that was better than the Blake Edwards version, which is so good. Yeah.
You're just reminding me, Peter, there have been several versions of the Viennese comedy that The Matchmaker is based on, and including Hello, Dolly.
Right. Sure. Blake Edwards also did a remake of the Truffaut film, The Man Who Loved Women. And, of course, there's the great Purple Noon, Patricia Highsmith, a René Clément film with Alain Delon, which was remade as Talented Mr. Ripley.
Which was terrific film. Yeah. Those are some great examples.
But, Peter, do you prefer The Magnificent Seven to Seven Samurai?
Are you kidding? I like Magnificent Seven a lot.
Yeah, they're both great films.
I mean, we're talking amazingly great to very good, but I'll take it.
Okay.
You know. Yeah, one of the big challenges, of course, is to take something that's specifically cultural and not ruin it in remaking it, and that's difficult. We had more recently, didn't we, have the film Intouchables was remade?
Right. Right. That was one. The Upside was with Bryan Cranston. Also, not many people know that the Kindergarten Teacher with Maggie Gyllenhaal that came out earlier this year was based on an Israeli movie.
Yeah. And so what advice do you have for filmmakers adapt? Do you try and keep it as culturally specific, but just in English? Or is that a road to disaster to do that?
I think it's sort of a disaster. I mean, my feeling is it's the same thing with, you know, don't remake a great movie. Remake a movie that could have been great but didn't work, you know. And then but if you do something culturally so different that you're essentially taking the same story but you're transposing it into an entirely different realm, I think that's the best. So Boudou, Save from Drowning is, you know, this you know, homeless hobo who is played by Michelle Simone, you know, wonderfully sloppy, great actor, you know, falls into the sin. And then you transpose it to Beverly Hills and Nick Nolte and Richard Dreyfuss and Bette Midler. I think that's the way to do it.
Yeah. There's just so many of these remakes that
I had forgotten Victor Victoria, which was a movie I really liked.
Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of films that we don't even – Some Like It Hot is actually based on an old German film. I've never seen it. But, you know, there are a lot of these movies. The Departed, the Scorsese film, is based on a Chinese movie called Internal Affairs.
We have EDB writes on the page, Goyokan remade as the master gunfighter. And in addition to the Magnificent Seven, Seven Samurai was Battle Beyond the Stars as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right. But awful examples, according to EDB.
Yeah, right. Can we include Godzilla?
Yeah.
Okay, how many, remade in Hollywood.
Yeah, that's right.
How many times?
Although, yeah, but Raymond Burr was cut, inserted yeah, right. into the original, right?
Right.
So was that an American production?
And that was George Takei's first job, was dubbing some of the voices for that, he said.
You're so knowledgeable about Japanese culture, Charles, and how that is in animation. But it seems to me, you know, when it comes to Japanese horror, this has been a real challenge, taking these very, you know, things that are perhaps even more frightening because of cultural references, and then figuring out, well, what's an equivalent in American culture?
Well, part of that is that there's a huge Japanese tradition of horror stories. And there are encyclopedias of monsters and kinds of ghosts. So it's something that's very much a part of Japanese culture in a way I don't think we have them. There are also degrees of how scary ghosts can be. There's a film that's coming up here called Oko's Inn, where a little girl goes to work in her grandmother's hot springs inn and discovers there's a ghost there of a little boy who loved her grandmother as a little girl. We wouldn't do that.
All right, for our critics, Charles, Amy, and Peter, I'm Larry Mantle. Thank you for joining us. I sure hope to see you Sunday afternoon, 1:30, Theater at Ace Hotel. Our critics on stage, the big screen will show clips of all the Oscar-nominated Best Pictures. It's going to be a wonderful event. Already more than 1,000 tickets sold, and we have some left. Want to make sure that you get in on it. KPECC.org/in-person. Please join us at the historic Theater at Ace Hotel Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock, and have a wonderful weekend.
Podcasting is supported by Fox Searchlight, presenting The Favorite. Now nominated for 10 Academy Awards, including director Yorgos Lanthimos, actress Olivia Colman, supporting actresses Emma Stone and Rachel Weisz, original screenplay, and Best Picture of the Year. Now playing.